Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and I am pleased today to welcome Kristen Undersma, who is the author of Dignity, Not Debt, An Abolitionist Approach to Economic Justice from the University of California Press. Kristen, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if we could, why don't you tell folks a little bit about who you are and what you do and how you came to this particular project?
Sure. So my name is Kristen Undersma. I'm a professor, law professor at Rutgers Law School. I teach bankruptcy and commercial law, which is something that I never, ever imagined that I would ever be focusing on. So the story of this book is actually the story about why I teach bankruptcy in the first place. So when I was in law school, I really wanted to my goal was to focus on justice issues. I cared about social justice. I cared about fighting the prison industrial complex. I cared about constitutional rights. And I transferred from ASU to Harvard because I wanted to become a professor, because my ASU professors told me, okay, if you become a law professor, you can do interesting policy work. So in my admissions letter, I said, all right, I'm going to do this, all the social justice stuff and cool policy work on these intersectionality issues and constitutional rights, criminal justice, so forth and so on. And I got admitted there. And my first week, actually, there was this lunch lecture offered by Elizabeth Warren. And at the time, this was 2005, right? So she was a bankruptcy professor. She wasn't yet a senator.
Just a mere professor at Harvard Law.
I mean, she had already had a huge reputation for being just phenomenal and brilliant, and her classes were always so hard to get into. But anyways, it was going to be a lecture on the Socratic method. Now, at this time, I thought, well, the Socratic method, that's oppressive and anti-feminist. And I'm going to go to this lecture. I'm going to raise my hand and I'm going to say, you know, no, like, you shouldn't, cause your students so much distress to just like make things easier for the white guys in the class and all this. But, you know, most of you have heard Elizabeth Warren speak, knows that she is quite persuasive for many of us. And she started talking about how, you know, if you really care about equality in the classroom, you have to make sure that you use the Socratic method. It's the only way, because I mean, I don't know if I'm sure people would disagree. But for her, she said, if you rely on only volunteers and you don't force everybody in the class to participate, it's going to be those white guys that get their hands up. And she's like, everybody needs to learn how to think on their feet, you know? And so the best thing to do is to just make sure that everybody can participate. And I was like, oh, wow, I hadn't really thought about it that way before. So I wrote her an email after that meeting and I said, I want to teach. I never thought I would use the Socratic method, but after hearing you speak, I kind of feel like a convert. So would you be willing to talk more with me about it? And she said, sure, I'm always interested in students that are interested in commercial law. And I was like, oh my God, what did I say in this email?
What have I done?
So I go to her office, like all prepared to say, look, you know, this is all nice and everything. I wanted to be a teacher and everything, but you know, I'm doing social justice stuff. I'm not doing this economic stuff. So that was what I prepared to say. And I started to say that. And she said, you know, if you really care about justice, you really ought to think about looking at these issues of bankruptcy. If you care about fighting racism and sexism and all these things, think about bankruptcy and commercial law, because, you know, this is this system is causing so much suffering for people who are marginalized. And right now, most of the people that are focusing on economic stuff are people that only care about free markets, economic efficiency, sort of, and are not looking at the justice side of things. So you could make a difference if you turned your attention to bankruptcy and commercial law. And so I did. And then I later found out from her husband that she was actually on the admissions committee and remembered my application and like had a plan to recruit me to like take my justice passion to bankruptcy and commercial law. So that's the story of why I'm interested in this. And then in terms of this book, it's a long time coming, really, because my own family filed for bankruptcy. My sister got sick. Insurance didn't cover it. My dad lost his business. They lost their house in foreclosure, they had to file for bankruptcy and get a fresh start. And I thought about, and I tell my students the story about my family at the start of class, and so many of them come up to me and say, you know, this happened to me, it happened to my family, it happened to my friend. And they're so relieved to hear somebody else share it, because there's still so much shame around it. And, the more research that I did, I was at the same time that this happened to my family. And then as I'm teaching and hearing more stories from my students, I'm also doing more and more research, starting with the Elizabeth Warren's research on bankruptcy, which proved that people don't file for bankruptcy because they're like reckless and stupid and, you know, running up debts on fancy electronics or fancy mortgages or, you know, luxury cars and things like that. They're filing for bankruptcy because in this country, you have to often turn to debt to get through an emergency or just to survive. The reasons they file are because of medical debt, family breakups, or job loss. So I had that in mind and like kept thinking about how the story of American debt is a lie. Then I connected with Abby Atkinson, who was, I was the TA, and she was in her contracts law class. And so that's how we became friends. And she's also thinking about these issues in her work, and especially focusing on the problem of credit policy in this country, where this idea that credit can also lead to prosperity and equality, that this is going to solve our inequality problems if we just give everybody credit, right? So she and I started talking about this during the pandemic, and she wrote a brilliant article called Borrowing Equality in Columbia Law Review, and then they invited me to write a response. So we started this discussion about, well, how should our household debt landscape actually look, right? Like, we know that this, what we have, everybody, well, not everybody, but those of us who study it know that it's rooted in lies. It's perpetuating inequality. It's causing so much suffering. So what's the alternative? And that's when I came up with this idea that, well, first of all, we need a totally new taxonomy for debt, because this whole idea that if you just stay away from bad debt and only take on good debt, that you're fine, you know, that's not actually reality. So what is the reality? So I came up with a new taxonomy and then basically a totally new approach to debt to try to help us figure out, okay, what kinds of debt are actually our policymakers should encourage and what should we actually move towards abolishing? So that's a very long story.
Excellent. So why don't we start with maybe the 30,000 foot view. So you're writing about what is often called household debt. So talk a little bit about sort of that category, and then give us an overview, right? How many people are we talking about? What are the numbers? What are the causes? And then I want to move into that taxonomy that you referred to help people understand how you are thinking about how we should be thinking about this kind of debt.
Sure. Yeah. So household debt, I use the term household debt rather than consumer debt, because consumer debt in the bankruptcy code, Congress now it's 2005, but they changed the bankruptcy code to make it much harder for people to get relief. And they use this term consumer debt. And they said, if you have consumer debt, then we're going to make it really hard for you to get relief. Okay. You look at the congressional history, and all of it is saying that consumer debt is abusive debt, and it's equated. And courts had to buy into that because you can't just treat business debt separate from consumer debt without some justification. It would be unconstitutional, right? Even though it's a very low bar, it can't be totally arbitrary. So the courts then looked and said, well, consumer debtors can be treated worse. Why? Because you look at the congressional history and consumer debt, that means these are abusive debts that people are racking up debts recklessly. So that's why I avoid the term consumer debt and I use household debt instead. And when I talk about household debt, I'm talking about basically any debt that households or individuals are also, you know, it can be a one person household, right? That people take on to survive and thrive. The problem is that for many households, our incomes are no longer sufficient to meet our basic needs, right? So you look at the fact that, like, you know, half of households can't afford rent, like the housing affordability is just, you know, out of control. You look at the fact that, you know, our medical debt, there's no other country in the world, right, that's wealthy where people can have a medical emergency and you're in financial crisis, right?
Medical debt is like literally not a thing that exists in most other places.
Right, exactly. And same with educational debt. So like, think about, you know, the trillions of dollars of educational debt that we have here. And just the idea that to get a basic education, you have to basically owe a house. There's no other wealthy country where that would even be conceivable, right? So you have this thing where just to do the basics, you already have to take on debt and then forget it. You know, we only really, because of things are so unaffordable, we only really earn enough to basically make ends meet for most Americans, you know, of course, like higher income Americans fine, but for even for like the middle class and, you know, still we have many Americans that are really, really struggling and food insecure and everything like that. But even for the middle class, right, if suddenly something happens, you lose your job, you have a medical emergency, now you need to take on even more debt in order to just break even. And often the terms of debt, especially for Black and Brown Americans and other marginalized Americans, the terms of this debt are often really predatory and abusive. So then we have what's called a debt spiral where people are just getting deeper and deeper in debt. And there's not the way that this country doesn't have a plan that like, okay, you have a financial emergency, here is some money for you. They did it during COVID, right? Can you imagine if during COVID, just think about what would happen if during COVID they were like, okay, everybody, you know, you're out of work, too bad. Like, what would have happened to households, to the whole economy? But they realized, no, like, somebody has an emergency, they're not having any income. We can't just give them a loan, obviously, because they're not going to be able to repay it unless magically they suddenly have more income down the road. You have to actually give a grant, like financing that doesn't have to be repaid in order to survive an emergency. But this is how we deal with emergencies in this country. And there's just really not a safety net.
You're right that more than a third of all U.S. households have debt that will eventually go into collection. Yes.
Yeah.
So this is not sort of around the margin stuff,
no.
Right? This is affecting a very, very broad base of the U.S. population.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So talk to us about the category, how we should think about debt and the categories we should think about it in.
Yeah. So the taxonomy that I have come up with has really two categories and a third dimension. So it's like the reasons that you might take on debt are either to survive or to have an opportunity, but that's of course overlapping, right? So like some debt that is for, you know, let's say you need a basic education to earn a living wage, right? That could be in both the category of survival debt and opportunity debt. You know, you like, for example, when I first went to college, I was, you know, working at a dry cleaners making minimum wage. So obviously like I needed a college degree to earn a living. Then once I had a college degree, I started earning like $13 an hour at the Rape Crisis Center, right? So now at that time in Chicago, that was, I think, more or less a living wage, right? But then when I went to, so that would be survival debt and opportunity debt, my undergrad degree, right? Because I needed it to make meet a minimum standard of living or standard of living consistent with human dignity, as I talk about. But then for my law school degree, I already could survive and actually have a life of dignity just with a college degree. So that law school degree was actually pure opportunity debt without also being survival debt. Other types of survival debt can be, of course, medical debt, car, right? Because we can maybe sometimes feel like in New York City, if I have a car and a motorcycle, actually, those are both just opportunity debt without being survival debt, because I could use public transit really to get around. But for most of Americans, you really can't get around without a car, right? To get to work, to get your kids to school, get to the doctors, you need a car. So that is really survival debt. You can also say opportunity, like it's overlap, because that, you know, could be sort of increasing your opportunity compared to like having to take the bus, right? So it's both survival and opportunity. And then the other dimension of this is extractive or non-extractive debt. So each of these loans could be offered without interest on non-predatory terms, or perhaps they are offered at really high interest rates. And maybe the lender knows or should have known that this person is never going to be able to repay. You know, there's in terms of like the subprime auto, for example, you know, how many dealers sort of their model depends on if they're in the subprime market. They know that the car is going to get repossessed, and then they're going to just sell that car again to somebody else, repossess it and sell it again. Meanwhile, they can still go after the original borrower for the amount left on the loan, right?
The story of the housing crisis and the Great Recession, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's like a systematized effort at targeting vulnerable populations and loading them with debt that folks knew would never be repaid.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Because there's money to be made. Yes. Is it any more complicated than that?
Right. No, that's exactly right. It really, and that extractive debt, like the way that I define it, is really debt that is, it provides a benefit for somebody other than the borrower and is substantially likely to harm the borrower. So it's like, other people are getting rich. These financial institutions are profiting. You know, various companies may be profiting, but like the actual borrower is no better off, and is in fact probably worse off as a result of this transaction.
So perfect. Why don't we? Can you talk a little bit about sort of what happens to people when they incur debt that they are unable to repay?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of empirical work on this now this goes back to the myth that people just file for bankruptcy, you know, just frivolously for any reason. And they maybe took on debt strategically, but the lengths that people go to before filing for bankruptcy, people will end up going without necessary medicine. They will end up cutting back how much they eat. They will have to miss out on utility bills. You know, they sort of juggle around which debts they can pay for a while. And they will do this for several years. And really, bankruptcy is only a last resort, because there is still so much shame around seeking relief because of these lies that, like, oh, if you're getting bankruptcy, then, you know, you're just abusing the system.
Debt collection. Talk a little bit about sort of that side of the industry.
Yeah.
The resources that folks do or do not have when they wind up in debt collection.
Yeah, I mean, it's really wild that really our state courts have become a tool for creditors and debt collectors. Like, that's the most common case in our state courts now, is debt collectors using the court system to extract from borrowers. And the problem is that, you know, most of these are default judgments, meaning that the person never actually shows up in court, either because they did not get the notice, they didn't understand the notice, they thought they wouldn't have any defense, or, you know, maybe they couldn't get there because they had they had to work, or, you know, whatever reason. Most people don't show up. I think it's over 90% that are default judgments. And then once that default judgment is out there, What happens then is that their wages can be garnished, or usually that it's most commonly going to be wage garnishment or bank garnishment, or sometimes it can be property seizure. But then we also have a problem, which is shocking. And I just, you know, learned this a few years ago, that the other thing that, that our state uses, actually, that debt collectors in like combination with the state use, is threats of arrest. So like if somebody doesn't respond to, once there is the judgment, right, and then they have to get another, they have to, the creditor has to go through the whole process, right, of actually turning that judgment into the garnishment order or whatever. But to do that, they need to know, like, what, where does the debtor work? What's the bank account? And if the debtor fails to provide the information, again, maybe they didn't provide it, or they didn't show up at that hearing, or they didn't send in the paperwork for maybe the same reasons that they didn't show up at the first one. Either they didn't receive it, or they weren't able to. And then there can be a contempt of court order out there, right? So somebody, and there's actually, you know, tens of thousands of Americans that sit in jail because they...
Because they're poor.
Because they're poor, exactly. Yeah.
So we still have debtors' prisons, right?
We do, absolutely, yeah. Still have debtors' prisons, yeah. And the thing that's so heartbreaking is that, like, there's actually, it's not that you can defend against debt collection. So many of these are, like, past the statute of limitations, or the debt collector may not have the right, it's like a debt buyer, somebody that bought the debt, right? They usually don't have the proper proof that they actually own the debt, right? So you could show up and say, okay, prove that you actually are entitled to this payment, and usually they can't. But that borrowers don't know that. They don't know their rights. And I think they, you know, it's just daunting to figure out how to even go about fighting something.
And they're unlikely to have lawyers, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because lawyers are expensive.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. And this is not a proceeding in which the state is obligated to provide a lawyer if you can't afford one, right?
That's exactly right. And you know, there are some nonprofits and various organizations that do this work, but they're just so under-resourced and so few and far between that, like, you know, recently I had somebody, I think maybe a student, that wanted help, like wanted legal representation, and was looking for like a nonprofit thing. And so I asked one of my colleagues that does that, and she was like, you know, I honestly like hesitate to even give them this number, because like the odds that this organization is going to have be able to help them are just so low. I don't want to like give them false hope that they're going to be able to get a lawyer. But there are some programs like, they're out there. It's very...
Not enough of them. They're under-resourced.
Yes. Yeah.
So what do we do about this?
Well, I mean, it's sometimes it makes me sad to even say this, because this thing seems so daunting, and like just where we are with our policy in this country right now. But like the only thing we can do, this is not going to change until people don't need debt to survive. That's first and foremost. Like, we cannot have, how is it that we tolerate this, that we have, it's just an expectation that you have a medical emergency and, you know, your life could be financially ruined, that how do we tolerate that you have to owe, you know, a whole house just to get an education? I talked to my Norwegian friends about this, you know, and they're just aghast, you know, and they say, you know, of course, they're like, here we have conservatives, you know, we have like people that are like hate immigrants and hate trans people. We have like those sort of right wing folks, but like even those, like the far right wing people that we know, like even they would never dream of like having a situation where the government was not involved in a medical system or an educational system.
And they would not, they do not allow so much of it to be in the private market, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's just subsidized. Like, of course, like, well, of course the government is going to deal with the medical things we have a system for, and why would that, you know, be an individual's responsibility? Why should, you know, you break your leg, now you have to pay for it? Like, that's, there's better ways to do it.
So how do we get there? right? So if you're giving us this vision, as you do in the last third of the book, of a world in which people do not need to take on debt in order to meet both those survival and opportunity needs.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen tomorrow, obviously, as you recognize. How do you encourage us to start thinking about this problem to move to a place where we can mitigate it?
Yeah, to be honest, I think we really need to do what we can to focus locally and at the state level, because there are some bright spots, some states that are really making progress on this. And I think when we think about like our power as individuals when it comes to the federal electorate, we're very far removed from it. But like take Minnesota, for example, they had recently a budget that includes free school meals to children, free tuition at public colleges for families earning up to $80,000 a year, up to 18 weeks of paid family and medical leave, expanded health insurance access, a child tax credit of $1,750 per child for households making up to $35,000, and then gradually phasing out up to like $96,250. And they did this by raising taxes just 1% from 9.85% to 10.85% on earnings over $600,000 for an individual and $1 million for a married couple. And they closed some corporate tax loopholes. So it's like, what is so frustrating about this is like, it's so freaking simple. Like, we have enough money and there are enough resources, you know, we just have to do a better job of like, have a fair system of taxation that, you know, is able to fund these things so that we don't have a situation where people cannot live lives of dignity at all and are like trying to take on debt in order to get that. But when you have to rely on debt to survive, you can't have a life of dignity because there's too much insecurity. There's too much fear. There's too much anxiety, the psychological toll, the medical, the health toll, you know, it's just, it makes me sad and it sort of sickens me that like we've decided to just accept that this is how things are in this country. And you would think this would be something that would be across the aisle, right? Like, why do we want this? Why do we tolerate it?
Well, but this is going outside the corners of your book, but I'm going to do it anyway. if we look at public opinion polling, right? Yeah. Large majorities in favor of some kind of universal healthcare program. Large majorities in favor of increasing tax rates on the very wealthy. Large majorities in favor of all kinds of things that you, I think, and I would both identify as steps forward to improve the well-being of large chunks of the population. But it is the political system itself and the way it is organized and how power is allocated that stops us from seeing those popular preferences translated into policy.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And that's why I sort of have more hope at the local level at this point, just because it does seem that there can be more traction there. Yeah,
I don't know if you've probably seen this. New York is part of the recent budget, right? Has set aside money in order to buy and forgive medical debt.
Yes, that's exactly the type of program that is like, you know, it's something that we can achieve these things. You know, a whole like federal solution seems pretty far away from possible, but there are states that are doing things like that. Exactly.
You're listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking with Kristen Andersma, who is the author of Dignity, Not Debt, An Abolitionist Approach to Economic Justice, new out from University of California Press. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.